I'm Emanuela, also known as Emma Blake Morsi, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Creative Climate Leadership Podcast. This is a podcast about the radical leading role of the arts in this age of converging crises. Today, we'll be delving into emerging technology and reimagined innovative spaces and how they are influencing the creative landscape. From exploring the new toolbox of offerings available through emerging technology, such as virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and other multimedia technologies in creative spaces, but also how they can be harnessed for sustainable progress, the opportunities they present, and also the risks we do need to be mindful of. In this episode, we'll be joined by Alistair Gentry, a writer and artist who also took part in CCR 2023 UK with me.
Yeah, it's really exciting to be here. I'm Alistair. I'm a writer and artist. I've been working for decades now as a performance artist, a writer. I've written fiction, drama, journalism, which I still do a little bit of. I make work which is primarily for outside a conventional theatre or art gallery spaces. I work very closely with particular communities, sometimes over very long periods of time, such as on the Isle of Portland, where I've been working with that community for nearly 10 years now. Genuinely by popular demand, they won't let me stop making that work. But that's great. You know, I love it. And that work continues even when I'm not there. And that's developed into a huge kind of mapping, kind of ecological, critical access mapping, disability first kind of project, you know, which I love and maybe I'll talk a bit about later. But yeah, generally I make things that are very involved with face-to-face conversation with people. That's a huge part of my work. And it's become increasingly important to me to do that work sustainably in every sense, you know, kind of in terms of ecologically, but also in terms of our energy as people and, you know, our careers and lives and the ability to just live and be happy, you know, which I think is a massively important thing to everyone. And I think, as we spoke about, I think at CCL, that's one of the things that I think we need to kind of bring to the foreground is that we're not fighting for a world where everybody gets dragged down and, you know, has a miserable life and, you know, can't do anything. We're fighting for a world where everybody gets opportunities and everybody has a nice life and everybody gets what they need to be happy. So, you know, it's not about misery, it's about joy. So that's what drives me in the work I do.
I guess the first question being, what role do you think creative tech has as part of climate action?
Well, I don't know, to roll back a little bit, one of the things, you know, as somebody who is kind of, you know, kind of disabled and gay and kind of otherwise marginalized in a lot of other ways, I'm self-taught too as well. So, you know, I don't come from a kind of family that would have been in higher education or in the arts or anything like that. So I, you know, I've done that myself. So I'm really interested in other people like that for a start. And what I've always said in my kind of teaching and mentoring other people is that, you know, it's like, you sometimes as a marginalized person or a minority, you get accused of like playing the race card or playing the whatever card. It's like play the cards you've got because, you know, slam those down on the table because you can bet that people with better cards, with dealt a better hand to start with than you, are playing their cards. So why shouldn't you play yours? Play those cards. So in a similar vein, I think, you know, our opposition, you can be sure they're using all the tools at their disposal. So why are we, you know, with one hand tied behind our backs, you know, we should use all the tools at our disposal as well, you know, and, you know, use the, you know, use everything that's available to us and, you know, use it for our purposes and turn those things to our purposes and turn the things that are used against us back against them, you know, so use those techniques. And again, this is the thing that we've seen with the right over the past 10, 15 years. They have very effectively weaponized the kind of the language and the techniques and the flaws of the left and the center in terms of their disunity. And they've seen where our kind of vulnerable points are and attack them mercilessly. So, you know, it's just, you know, I think people on the left quite rightly, or progressive people have quite rightly, to some degree, had a reputation for being pushovers because they've been, kindness is great, but, you know, our opponents don't value kindness. But
But I mean, I guess for your work especially, you kind of touched on this a little bit. But yeah, what was the kind of catalyst for the work that you do? And like, what does it ultimately mean to you?
I kind of started out way back as kind of being interested in playwriting and the stage and that kind of stuff. And I kind of got a little bit into that, but got intensely frustrated with it because it was just, there were so many rules about how you had to do things and the audiences for it were so narrow. And, you know, like I worked a little bit for the BBC and it was then, you know, like 30 odd years ago and still is an intensely kind of patriarchal kind of place, you know, both in its kind of overarching philosophy and in its like the day-to-day interactions. It's like working with dad, you know, it's like working with centrist dad the whole time that you're there, you know. It's always like, yeah, moderation, both sides, you know, which is one of the things which I think has again been weaponized against people who are interested in fairness and listening to both sides. It's like, you know, we're in an era of false equivalence. It's like, you know, my free speech is kind of balanced against somebody having the free speech to advocate for me to be killed, for example. You know, that's not a balanced debate. You know, that is not two sides of a debate, is it? You know, like my existence is not up for debate and should not be up for debate. Nobody's right to exist or just be should not be up for debate. Initially, so I kind of went away from that kind of traditional kind of arts or media world, and I became interested in just teaching myself and kind of making. And back then, like if you wanted to make something digital or electronic, you had to build it or program it yourself. So, and again, I came from a background where I couldn't learn that from anybody else, so I taught myself. But for a long time, I just kind of had my head down and I was kind of doing my own work without much regard for the wider world, frankly. And then kind of as time went on, I guess I became woke. That's what happened. So I kind of realized, you know, to kind of adapt that slogan, you know, there's no creativity on a dead planet, right? So, you know, and that we need to work together, and that the best work that I enjoyed most by other people was work that really kind of engaged with the places and people that were around them and with the world as a whole, and kind of wasn't necessarily crusading in an obvious way, but actually at least asked people to think, you know, and to kind of reassess where they were and what their assumptions were.
And I wonder, you know, as society kind of continues to evolve, we're seeing all these new resources and tools that are available to us to reimagine the ways we kind of communicate with each other and kind of create impact. And I wonder, is there any tools specifically that are the most significant in like the work of yours today? What kind of stuff are you utilizing now, and kind of what has that change been like for you?
It's been an explosion, as you will know, like over the last few years of the kind of the AI-based stuff, which is kind of a little bit weird to me. It's kind of... I don't know. There's never been really a shortage of tools, I don't think. You know, even pre-digital, there was never any shortage of tools. What there's a shortage of is good uses of them, or, you know, what is, you know, a guideline of like how you do good with them, whether that's good work or actual kind of social good. You know, there's a lot of things, particularly with the explosion of the kind of the tech industry over the last like 10, 20 years. People build things just because they can. And they don't necessarily, and again, especially this kind of tech bro mentality, they don't think about really how or who is going to use it. And often that means they're built in a very kind of normative for the people that make them kind of way. You know, they have horrible interfaces. They, you know, they're very ableist. You know, they apply tiny little type on them, you know, so... which is ageist and ableist and all of these things. But these considerations just never enter their minds. You know, it's not a sinister conspiracy or anything. It's just like their attitude is just, oh, we make the tools, we don't care what you do with them. So I think what's kind of lacking, we're not lacking in tools. All the tools are out there for you to use if you want to use them now, you know, which wasn't the case when I started out. So we've got this almost infinite number of tools we can use. But I think what we really need is people who are using those tools or know how to use those tools to share what they're doing with them. I mean, to really answer your question directly, again, this has changed a bit, but for a while, Social media for me, because that when in its kind of heyday, you know, the kind of pre-Elon Musk, social media in general was the place where I found community. That's the place where I connected, you know, especially when I wasn't, I mean, I live in London now, but like I was living in different parts of the world and in kind of outside of London in kind of quite obscure parts of, you know, like way up in the north of Scotland or wherever. But I found community online, you know, with social media. And that was the most important thing, not any tool as such. But it was, again, it goes back to the work I did. It was people that were important there. And the social media enabled me to kind of connect in ways, to do it publicly as well, to kind of show community as well and to show solidarity and to be there for other people, you know, virtually, you know, if not physically. So for a while, that was the thing. And I got so many kind of friends and colleagues and connections and work and ideas and things, you know, all coming through those communities. And going back even further again, you know, like I'm old, you know, I remember things like IRC channels and like the early days of the internet, when those things were like real hotbeds of like real communities of people distributed all over the world as well. So that was, again, like people who are as old as me, you know, I really lament the loss of that, you know, those early days of that hope, which I think is one of the things that we've lost, that hope, you know, the early days of the internet. And I've been lucky enough to kind of work with like Tim Berners-Lee, who kind of invented the World Wide Web, you know, and his optimism was amazing in those early days.
Clav, Sir Tim Berners-Lee. It's basically the person who invented the World Wide Web in, I think it was 1989. And it was just, what he invented was basically the frameworks of kind of the coding necessity that was then possible to build more stuff off of. And what was so special about that is that it was also his awareness of what he had created, which is so incredibly, like, I guess ultimately, like, the possibility of what he had made, he understood that it could be not just life-changing, but could completely change the face of the world we lived in a way, in a sense of that he wasn't sure, but he was optimistic of it. And so he was like, I'm going to literally make it accessible and give it out freely. And, like, just that notion of understanding, like, how valuable open sourcing is, the kind of the contextualization of someone's responsibility, not just to humankind in that way, but to the kind of the world in the sense of, how can I really take value in what we're developing, but also who am I developing for, and actually how do I build a real longevity and the impact of that in mind? Kind of just thinking about, you know, just emerging spaces in general and emerging technology, what kind of intentions or principles do you feel like we should be developing these platforms with, or these kind of tools with?
Well, I mean, one of the things, Oxbox Trustbot, which I did with the Open Data Institute, which is Tim Berners-Lee's kind of institution, nonprofit that he founded, it was examining exactly these things. It's like, who's kind of normal is being represented there? And, you know, like, nobody's normal, you know, everybody's like, again, I've been writing about this recently, you know, I've been increasingly thinking that everybody's divergent. I think, you know, it's like 90% of people on Earth are divergent. It's the people who run the planet who are kind of divergent from the rest of us. They're the ones who have abnormal expectations of the rest of us. You know, it's just they're the ones who are kind of inhuman and not quite right. You know, it's the rest of us that are perfectly fine. You know, it's just we happen to diverge from the people who are in control of us, you know. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside. Yeah, no, so I in that work, I really kind of extensively researched, you know, where these things were being, where the sources of this knowledge was. And the sources of this knowledge and the philosophy behind them is this kind of Californian kind of libertarian thing, which kind of runs like the letters in a stick of rock through so much of our technology. All of the assumptions of it are of, you know, like a white kind of 30-something Californian libertarian, even politically, it's kind of this libertarian kind of center-rightish kind of American kind of attitude that goes through all of that technology. And kind of that work, DocsBox, was kind of trying to kind of game out what it would be like. You know, for a start, the aesthetic and the attitude of the whole thing was kind of deliberately queer. So it's like an imagination of like what would like a queer device be, you know? It's like, you know, and again, this is an old thing, you know, like Brian Eno, I think, like in the early 80s, was talking about kind of, you know, imagining, you know, what an African drum machine might sound, you know, how an African, you know, drum machine that, you know, a drum machine that was built in Africa, like technologically how that might work. Well, its assumptions might be, you know, outside of like a Western view and kind of, so this is not a new idea, but I still think it's such an interesting idea. It's like to sort of, again, we can do this in art, imagine, I've just realized, of course, you know, we have this kind of Afrofuturism thing, which is going on since the 70s, you know, which is exactly that. It's imagining, you know, a world that was recentered around, you know, kind of Africa. And what if Africa was the center of space exploration and, you know, all of the teams that were, again, white endeavors in the 60s and 70s, yeah.
Well, and I think often we can feel quite limited by society because we almost feel like we can really struggle because just how ingrained and entrenched capitalism is, patriarchal systems are in our kind of day to day. It's really hard often to actually reimagine these new ways of being and to kind of, you know, explore these experimental kind of alternatives, which is why actually when you kind of explore like what we've just shared about Afrofuturism, the excitement within that as just even like the kind of concept building of reimagination is so special because it really allows that exploration around, you know, creatively, what does it mean to not just center people who actually have been on the complete, not just the fringes, but have been actually so exploited historically for such extended periods of our history, but equally, what does it mean to also give and lean into a lot of those pre-colonial kind of legacies that are incredibly rich in like knowledge and, you know, information and science and music and storytelling and how, and what does it mean to kind of really celebrate that pre-colonial value that Africa does also possess? And I guess it's about trying to kind of reimagine it with like a lens that goes beyond a lot of the exploitation that we have experienced. And I actually, off the back of that, wonder in terms of like how we, you know, has knowledge progresses and, you know, at various accelerated rates, we are kind of seeing this like increased adaptation of these new digital tools that do pose both, you know, a risk and an opportunity. What other kind of opportunities do you think tech can afford us? And, you know, what should we also be mindful of in this development of it?
Protest is good, but I think resistance is actually a more kind of long-term solution. I think what we, because a protest is there and it's over, but I think resistance is a lifelong process, you know, and it's something that you can do. And resistance is something that you can engage in if you are, for example, disabled and not able to be out on the streets as you might want to be or wish to be. And again, this is kind of some of the other work I've done has been a lot of research with disabled people and disabled artists and about how they feel about, you know, the climate crisis and all of these things and how much they want to do and how frustrated they are as they are in other sectors of society by society's inability to make it possible for them to do the things that they have the right and the wish to do. But yeah, I think protest is great, but resistance is what brings change. You know, resistance is the thing that we can embody every day in everything we do. You know, we can think about whether we're using the tech or the tech is using us. We can think about who benefits from our use of it. You know, are we benefiting more? You know, think about what we're giving up in order to benefit from those things. And again, you know, the work I've done is kind of often centered around that. You know, it's about that idea of, you know, we shouldn't be vulnerable to the kind of the common tactic of saying, you know, oh, well, you're against capitalism and you have an iPhone, you know, therefore you are invalid, you know, which is, you know, the typical kind of basic response, you know, when they can't argue with anything else you've said. But, you know, again, like I said at the top, you know, I think we actually have the right and the need to use those tools for our good. And these tools are going to be around whether we like it or not. So we should use them for our benefit.
These tools are going to continuously exist. And that's not to say we have to, you know, just let it go kind of like brazenly. But what I do mean is that, like, instead of feeling like we are powerless to this happening at us and to us, there is something really much more empowering to understand, like, actually, how can we not only just subvert them, but also to kind of utilize them at the forefront of reimagining how we use them? And I think what's really integral, actually, is that we will see people adopt these alternative uses for, like, especially within the creative sector, we're probably one of the sectors that are also the most vulnerable in terms of how people kind of have been developing these tools, kind of make processes faster. you can't address just climate action and climate justice without addressing, you know, social justice, without addressing disability justice, without addressing racial justice. You know, these are all part of the intersectional lens in which we must look at the environmental and sustainability crisis, because otherwise you're missing out on a very key, important part of these processes in making stuff accessible and equitable.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's even scarier because, as you say, I mean, as I often say as well, you know, there can be no climate justice without social justice, without economic justice, without racial justice, because it's all part of the same system. You know, it's all part of the same system that is broken and wrong and does not serve the vast majority of the people on this planet, or the planet itself, or anything else that lives on this planet. You know, it is completely destructive to everything that is worth living for. And also, I was just thinking as well, you know, just I think these tech companies, you know, with their software and the hardware that they provide, I think they really don't mean to, but they're giving us power. I mean, it's a question, you just take the power and use it in not the way that they intend for you to use it. You know, it's just I think that's the thing I often put in my biographies. It's just, you know, and because it's true, I genuinely love taking technology and tools and using them for things that they were never intended to be used for. You know, that gives me great joy and power, you know. So, you know, take that power and use it, you know, especially since they don't want you to have that power or realize that they're giving you that power. Just realize it and take it and use it.
Also kind of looking into like other people might be listening who are part of organizations or the kind of businesses as well. I think, what advice would you give to organizations maybe who are actually looking to build authentic, ethical approaches to incorporating new tools into their processes? What advice would you give them? And is there anything that they need to be kind of, as an organization, need to be mindful of?
People first, tools second. You know, it's like the tools are not the most important thing. The most important thing on earth are the things that live on it, including us. You know, tools are secondary. So think about what you want to achieve and who you want to reach and who you want in your community first. Don't have a tool and then think, what can we do with this tool? Because that's the thing that plagues the tech industry. It's like a multiplicity of tools looking for, you know, their answers looking for a question, you know? You know, their answers to a question nobody was asking in a lot of cases. You know, it's like, well, it's like AI drawings. It's like that's totally the answer to a question nobody was asking. You know, no artist has been thinking, yeah, I'd really love to not have to paint anymore, you know, as a painter. You know, it's just, it's bullshit. Nobody wanted that. Nobody was asking for that, right? So I think that's the key, is like, so don't have a tool and then see what you can do with it. No, do it the other way around. Think about what tools you need in order to do the things you want and need to do and reach the people you need in your community.
In this term that I've used for some of my other like research projects, which is access as a creative tool. And it's the idea that you literally start any kind of decision making from when you're planning or designing something or even developing something, is that access is like embedded into the creative development of it. So it's not something you kind of add on as like an additional thing. You know, access to these kind of resources and cutting edge technology is often limited, and we kind of have them significantly unrepresented, as we've already talked about. But ultimately, what are the kind of immediate needs that you're seeing among your own peers or communities that you're working with? And what kind of solutions or approaches do you feel would be more poignant?
Well, again, I mean, then it's not my project, but I worked on two projects kind of in my own kind of East End community called the Bank Job and Power. You know, the first was about kind of eliminating debt in our own community. And the second has been kind of having a whole street in Walthamstow, East London, go solar as well, you know, and for it to be community owned and run as well, which is now kind of, they're kind of continuing to try and build that out to kind of other streets in London, other streets in other parts of the UK. I think it's really important, and I come from a background of artist-led groups as well. I think it's really important for groups and communities to sort of build their own kind of space, not necessarily literally and physically, but to build their own spaces, you know, to kind of build your spaces where everybody who needs to be there can be there, as you were saying. You know, think about what we need, what tools we need to use or not use in order for everybody whose voice should be there, for their voice to be there, you know. So, I mean, I think it's kind of happening. I think the problem is, again, as I think we discussed quite a lot at CCL, the lack of things being joined up. You know, there's lots of people doing things in small groups or little kind of peer groups. And because we often or usually or mostly don't have mainstream kind of media representation or visibility, we often don't even know that somebody's doing something amazing, you know, 10 miles away from us, you know. And we often work as activists or as community leaders or whatever in very small, atomized little groups. And that is our weakness. You know, it's just we need to be together more. And it's happening, but it's a slow process. And it's being kind of impeded by kind of the implosion of social media, and it's kind of the decreasing usefulness of social media. Yeah, I mean, I invite you and everyone to check out the Open Data Institute that I mentioned previously, because that's what they're all about, you know, is about make citizen data, making sure the data is open, you know, and free, and not just in the sense of no cost, but also in the sense of usable and you kind of useful to everybody, you know, that it's not away in silos, and that it, and that you, the data that you generate around everything you do inevitably nowadays is yours, you know. And that I'm also really glad you reminded me as well of like the energy usage of tech and AI in particular, because I've been looking at this really closely recently, and it a shocking amount. It's using about, I don't know, something like 4% of the entire Earth's power is going to like servers, media centers. And I think there's a report by Greenpeace that it could go up to like 15 or 20% in the next 10 years. So that's a huge, huge issue. It's something like I'm not going to do a figure because I'd be making it up, but it's a huge like kilowatt hours figure. It's something like every day, the equivalent of like two nuclear power stations or something, kind of just to serve like this platform we're on, for example, like video conferencing, all of these things, you know. And this is something that's not really being spoken about, certainly not by the industry. Their energy usage is huge. They use huge amounts of water to cool the server centers as well, which again is a thing which is like a massive issue, particularly in places like the United, well, in the UK as well now. Germany, like some of their rivers are so low now that their ships can't navigate the rivers anymore at the moment. Literally reading that today. So they've had low rainfall and there's so much water being drawn out of the rivers, you know. So this is not a problem for like, you know, not just a problem for, well, as we all know already, climate crisis is a problem for everybody. But some people think, oh, this is a developing world thing. No, it's not. It's Germany. It's the UK. We will literally be running out of water in these countries too, with all the political and social ramification and economic ramifications of that for all of us, everybody on Earth. So, yeah, we do definitely need to be mindful of just the amount of energy that tech is using as well, and try to find ethical and sustainable alternatives to that, because we can't go on with the whole Earth being covered in, like, AI servers and unless we go to the Matrix thing where we're like literally batteries for the AI servers, you know. But other than that, I can't really see a solution. You know, again, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. So we need to kind of do better with less.
And that actually feels like such a poignant, perfect way to kind of round off. And you've already given us a kind of closing kind of call to action to check out as well. So I think that's really vital for people to really kind of take the time, do that additional research and do explore that, see how your data is being used. What was the website again, sorry?
It's theodi.org, yeah.
Thank you so much as well, Alistair. It's been so great to really unpack all of this with you. Thank you so much, Alistair Gentry. Thanks for joining us. What have you taken away from this episode? Feel free to share your thoughts with us using hashtag CCL podcast. And you can find links to resources mentioned in the description of this episode or visit the CCL website at creativeclimateleadership.com for more information. This podcast is constructed by the Creative Climate Leadership Alumni Network, an evolving network growing from the CCL program led by Julie's Bicycle, a pioneering UK-based non-profit mobilising the arts and culture to take action on the climate and ecological crisis. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to the Creative Climate Leadership podcast and get in touch with us on ccl@juliesbicycle.com. This podcast is produced by Hum Studio Interactive in co-creation with Julie's Bicycle. We thank our sponsors Nordic Culture Fund, Swedish Postcode Lottery, and Porticus.